The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated February 28/March 7, 2022. It is again bordered in bright red with a slim white border, inner border. And then the background of today's portrait on Time's cover is also in orangey red in gradations from dark red to light red into orange. And Time, in its large block letters, is on top of that backdrop in kind of a pale orange in capital letters. It's superimposed on the orange. Now, the first headline one sees above Time is Kid of the Year, Ambassador for Kindness, Orion, O-R-I-O-N, Jean, J-E-A-N, and that could be Jean if he's pronouncing it in the French style, 11. So this is an 11-year-old, Orion, and he's seated on an orange-colored cube, I suppose one would say, superimposed again upon the Time cover in red-orange gradations. Orion's wearing what I call white sneakers, but they are high tops. And he's got black pants and a white T-shirt over which there's a long-sleeved blue, yellow, and white plaid shirt, and he's got that rolled up. The sleeves are rolled up to approximately his elbows. He's wearing some kind of a wristband. It's metallic. I cannot read any inscription if there is one. He's a person of color, and he has close-shaved black hair. He's wearing brownish glasses, and he's really smiling. He's grinning at that camera lens. At his feet is a small bouquet of flowers. It's like a posy tied with a blue ribbon, and they look like wildflowers, perhaps. They're hard to see, but it's a mixture, very colorful mixture with lots of green leaves at his feet. And this is Orion, the ambassador for kindness. Now moving into the Time Magazine text, we have for the record, they were not allowing me to go inside just because I was carrying the burqa. And burqa is spelled B-U-R-Q-A. And that was spoken by Muskan Khan, K-H-A-N, a college student who's become a symbol of the resistance against a spate of decisions by government-run schools in the Indian state of Karnataka to ban the hijab. H-I-J-A-B, in a February 8 interview with news outlet NDTV. 4% is the amount of stock in Saudi Arabia's state-run oil giant Aramco, A-R-A-M-C-O, that the country will move to a sovereign wealth fund per an announcement February 13, a transfer of wealth valued at nearly $80 billion. 965, the weight in metric tons of avocados sent to the U.S. from Mexico in 2020. February 12, Mexico's Department of Agriculture confirmed exports had been suspended until further notice following a threat made to a USDA inspector. We have attended too many vigils, spoken by Yulin, Y-U-H hyphen L-I-N-E, New, N-I-O-U, New York State Assemblywoman, who represents the New York City District, where an Asian American woman Christina Yuna Lee was fatally stabbed February 13 in an interview later that day with the New York Times. The situation is highly undesirable and the government feels worried and sorry about it. Spoken by Carrie Lam, L-A-M, Hong Kong's chief executive, in a February 14 statement addressing the onslaught of a fifth wave of COVID-19 on the city. 1,200 years, length of time, since a drought in the American Southwest, like the ongoing one, lasted two decades, according to a February 14 report in Nature Climate Change. Do not eat soap. U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, in a February 13 tweet responding to an Uber Eats commercial that aired during the 2022 Super Bowl featuring celebrities eating household products to show the service delivers more than food. And finally, Camilla will be known as Queen Consort, a quote from Queen Elizabeth II in a February 5 statement confirming her sincere wish that Camilla, Duchess of Cornwall, be called Queen upon Prince Charles's succession to the British throne. Under the heading The Brief, School's Out, by Katie Riley, R-E-I-L-L-Y, school districts across the U.S. are grappling with financial challenges and fewer students. This is the brief opener. Five years ago, there were 37,049 students enrolled in Oakland, California public schools. Today, that number is down nearly 10%. A decline the district attributes to lower birth rates, a lack of affordable housing, and the pandemic causing more families to leave the Bay Area. And after a marathon debate that stretched 8 hours, the city school board did what many others may soon have to consider, voting February 9 to close or merge nearly a dozen schools. Education experts say the Oakland plan, which will affect the district's now roughly 33,000 students and their families, reflects the hard choices facing school districts nationwide as they contend with enrollment declines and funding challenges that have been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. School districts are between a rock and a hard place. They need to be financially responsible, but they also have a fundamental responsibility to the well-being of their students, says Thomas Dee, D-E-E, a professor at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education, who has researched public school enrollment loss. I don't envy the difficult choices they are facing right now. The Oakland Unified School District, OUSD, Board of Education voted 4-2 to close 7 schools over the next 2 years, merge 2 other schools, and eliminate some grades in 2 others. Board member Mike Hutchinson, who opposed the measure, said it amounted to war on the community. But Oakland Superintendent Kyla Johnson Trammell said it was a necessary step toward addressing serious dilemmas facing the district, citing long-term financial challenges and the high costs of operating a large number of schools while trying to offer students a quality education. The district says declining enrollment and attendance have led to a decrease in revenue, as it faces pressure from county officials to reduce a $90 million budget shortfall. The closures and mergers could save Oakland schools $4 million to $14.7 million annually, according to an analysis by the district. We're both addressing not only a financial crisis, but a quality crisis in terms of reaching our mission and vision of having high-quality community schools across the district, Johnson Trammell said. The measure drew fierce protests from students, parents, and educators. Many argued the plan will disproportionately affect black students in low-income neighborhoods, taking them away from a familiar school community, and in some cases forcing them to attend a new school farther from home. While black students represent 23% of students across the school district, they make up 43% of students at the school slated for closure, according to the local news site, Oakland Side. instead of investing time to close down schools that serve majority black and brown students, invest your time as a district to build community and to empower students. Samantha Powell, a student director on the OUSD Board of Education, said during the meeting, "This is a school district and not a business." Other school districts around the country are facing similar issues. Dee tracked an unprecedented decline in public school enrollment during the pandemic and found public K-12 schools lost roughly 1.1 million students in fall 2020, with enrollment declines concentrated in districts that started the year with remote-only learning. Total public school enrollment in the U.S. fell 3% in 2020-21 school year compared with the previous year, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. Marguerite Rosa, director of Georgetown's Edunomics Lab, which studies education finance, says Oakland's school closure plan is a glimpse of what's coming for a lot of districts, as she sees many losing students and stretching limited resource across too many schools. Chicago Public Schools saw a 3% enrollment drop for the 2021-22 school year compared with 2020-21. The district had nearly 439,000 students in 2002-03. Now it has about 339,000. St. Paul Public Schools in Minnesota saw enrollment fall 6.3% this school year, and the school board voted to close six schools. A lot of districts right now are holding on to some of their federal relief money and using it to kind of backstop these cuts, Rosa said, referring to the $190 billion given to schools in COVID-19 relief packages passed out by Congress. And that money is going to run out. When it does, more schools could face drastic budget decisions, and students will be most affected. Dee says it's important to pay close attention to where students are sent after their schools close, whether they are sent to high-quality schools with better resources or to lower-performing schools that lack necessary funding to accommodate that influx. Simply speaking of closures without talking about thoughtful strategies for reinvestment in these vulnerable children would be problematic, he says. Schools Out by Katie Riley. And it's also reported by Eloise Berry, Madeline Carlisle, Tara Law, Sonia Mansour, Ciara Nugent, Billy Perigo, and Olivia B. Waxman. That's referring to all of the Brief articles. More from the Brief news. Here's the news ticker. Three items. U.S. plans to beef up Pacific presence. The U.S. said February 12 it plans to reopen an embassy in the Solomon Islands for the first time since 1993 as part of efforts to counter China's expanding influence in the Pacific region. The island nation switched its diplomatic allegiance from Taiwan to China in 2019. Senators, CIA has secret data on Americans. Partially declassified February 10, a 2021 letter from Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Heinrich to intelligence officials alleges the CIA has for years been collecting data in bulk that could affect Americans' privacy without a warrant. The senators are calling for the agency to publicly release more details about the program. Prince Andrew settles sex abuse case. British royal Prince Andrew has settled a lawsuit brought by Virginia Giuffre, who accused him of sexually assaulting her when she was 17, per a February 15 court filing. Andrew has denied the allegations. The prince will pay an undisclosed sum to Giuffre and will also make a donation to her charity in support of victims' rights. Here is a photo. It is black and white, mostly black, some shades of gray, one white polyangular spot in the upper left-hand almost corner, towards the center and corner. Primary mirror selfie is a shot in the dark by Jeffrey Kluger. 1 million miles from home, the James Webb Space Telescope is preparing for its job of peering deeper into space than any telescope ever has before. But on February 11, an onboard camera looked much closer, taking this selfie of the telescope's 21-foot-wide, 18-segment main mirror. Okay, I should have said it was a segment of white. Each of those segments can be moved in 7 axes for pinpoint focusing. In this image, the single bright segment is pointed directly at a star. The Bulletin by Madeline Carlyle. What Florida's Don't Say Gay bill means for LGBTQ kids. February 8, President Joe Biden condemned legislation swiftly moving through Florida's state legislature that would ban public school districts from encouraging classroom discussion of sexual orientation or gender identity. Supporters of the bill claim it would keep parents involved in their kids' educations. Critics have labeled it a discriminatory attempt by GOP lawmakers to stir support among their base at the expense of LGBTQ students. The Don't Say Gay bill is part of a wave of legislation targeting what can and cannot be said in public school classrooms across the U.S. A February 15 report by Penn America, a nonprofit organization that advocates for free expression, found 2022 has seen a rise in educational gag orders in state legislatures, including 15 bills that would ban discussion of LGBTQ identities. GOP lawmakers also introduced a record number of bills in 2021 targeting LGBTQ students, limiting their ability to play sports or access medical care. Specifically, the Florida bill seeks to ban LGBTQ instruction at primary grade levels. Florida does not have a statutory definition for that term at the moment, however, so critics argue it is unclear what age range it would apply to. At a recent state Senate hearing, a lawmaker gave the example of math problems framed with details like, Sally has two moms. That, the bill's sponsor said, is exactly what it aims to prevent. The legislation also allows parents to sue school districts over classroom discussions they deem inappropriate, opening the door to frivolous lawsuits, argues Kara Gross, legislative director and senior policy counsel of the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida. Critics say the bill will stop students from discussing LGBTQ friends or family members and prevent LGBTQ students, who often already face increased rates of stigma and isolation, from speaking about their very existence. NASA provided the photograph of the James Webb Space Telescope mirror. More brief news. News ticker. Sea level rise is predicted across the U.S. A February 15 government report estimates sea levels along the U.S. coast will, on average, rise by about a foot by 2050. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Administrator Rick Spinrod said during a news conference that the report serves as a wake-up call. Australia deems koalas endangered. As of February 11, koalas in eastern Australia are officially listed as endangered, as deforestation, droughts, bushfires, and disease continue to imperil the species. The Australian government has earmarked $36 million for their protection. Environmentalists say it will not be enough to solve long-term problems. Diversion of Afghan money draws anger. President Joe Biden signed an executive order February 11 that could redirect half of $7 billion in frozen funds from Afghanistan's central bank to U.S. families and victims of 9/11, sparking backlash among Afghans who feel a sense of betrayal and worry the move will effectively bankrupt the institution. Good question. How can Spotify, S-P-O-T-I-F-Y, regain trust after its Joe Rogan crisis? This is by Nick Popley, or Popley, P-O-P-L-I. As artists and fans boycott Spotify over its loyalty to Joe Rogan's controversial podcast, the popular streaming service now finds itself at a crossroads. Should it support dissatisfied subscribers and moderate potentially harmful content, or keep Rogan on its platform and chase the most profit possible? So far, it's tried to do both, and that's not going to help regain trust, crisis management experts tell Time. Spotify's stance over Rogan has raised questions about the company's responsibility to police the content on its platform and to take a stance on the podcasts it hosts. Despite its exclusive deal with Rogan, the company has tended to avoid labeling itself as a publisher, since it does not have advance approval of its shows and can remove episodes only if they run afoul of its content guidelines. It has removed about 6% of Rogan's episodes and added an advisory to any podcast that discusses the pandemic, but it is not cutting ties with the wildly popular host, who's been accused of spreading false narratives about COVID-19 and condemned for his repeated use of a racial slur. It shows they care more about profits than their reputation, says Stephen Fink, a crisis consultant and author. That is never a good position to be in. For Spotify, Rogan's podcast is a cash cow. It reaches an estimated 11 million listeners per episode, making it the streaming service's most popular podcast, and its millennial audience closely aligns with Spotify's target customer. But from a social consciousness perspective, experts say the company has mismanaged its crisis response and should have placed a greater emphasis on its long-term reputation. The first thing a company should consider when dealing with a controversy is how its various stakeholders are reacting, specifically its customers, says Jonathan Bernstein, a crisis manager. Choosing between stakeholders will not be an easy decision for a company like Spotify, crisis experts warn, but executives should let their values guide the way. Do they want to be known as a company that forgives Joe Rogan and supports anti-vaxxers, Fink asks, or do they want to be known as a company that protects its customer base? According to Eric Pliner, CEO of YSC Consulting, the most effective leaders are those who answer questions like these by looking at the intersection of their morals, ethical contexts, and job responsibilities. You have to realize there's no way to make everyone happy, he says. Instead of trying and thereby making no one happy, the alternative is to figure out what we really stand for and what we won't stand for. Here's a small article containing four smaller articles called Culture, Art Attacks by Eloise Berry. On his first day at work at a Russian art gallery last year, a security guard doodled eyes on the faceless figures in a valuable avant-garde painting, the gallery said February 7. He reportedly said he was depressed by the artwork. Though the piece was restored successfully, Russian police have since opened an investigation into the incident. Here, more scandalous vandalism and misguided touch-ups. Miraculous makeover. An 81-year-old amateur painter was credited with reviving the tourist economy of her town in northeastern Spain in 2012 after her botched restoration of a centuries-old fresco of Jesus in a local church went viral. Sticky situation. After staff at Cairo's Egyptian Museum dislodged the beard on King Tutankhamun's 3,300-year-old funerary mask in 2014, they stuck it back on with adhesive, scratching it in the process. Gallery graffiti. In 1974, a man in New York's Museum of Modern Art spray-painted "Kill Lies All" across Picasso's Guernica, in a protest over the Vietnam War. Escorted out by guards, he shouted, "Call the curator. I am an artist." Here are the brief milestones. Died Ivan Reitman, R-E-I-T-M-A-N, comedic auteur, by Ernie Hudson, who is an actor. Ivan Reitman was not always the funniest guy in person, but in his body of work, he was one of the greatest comedic geniuses of our time. He directed and produced so many beloved films, including National Lampoon's Animal House, Space Jam, Kindergarten Cop, and Ghostbusters, which I starred in. Reitman, who died February 12 at 75, knew what was funny, and he had the ability to bring it out on screen. In 1982, I ran into Reitman by accident on an elevator while shooting a movie. That's when he first mentioned Ghostbusters, and there was nothing in it for me. So I said, good luck with that, and then I auditioned anyway, and they loved me. My career would not have been the same if it were not for Reitman. Ghostbusters did not launch my career, but the movie resonated with so many people. It amazed me just how popular it became. The fandom grew in the weirdest ways and crossed generations. So many directors get in the way. I really admired that Reitman knew how not to. He did not interfere, and he trusted talent. I wonder how many comedians became comedians after watching his movies. There's a humanity that is vibrant and alive in Reitman's work that's rare and very special, and he showed over and over again he had an intuitive understanding of what brought people together and what people would respond to. Losing him feels like losing family. There's a small black and white photo here of Ivan Reitman, apparently on set shooting a film in an urban setting. He's wearing a parka, probably against the cold. He's wearing a headset. He has probably brown hair flopping around his forehead, presumably in a windy situation. There's some kind of a camera contraption behind him. It says Panavision on it. And he's smiling askance, not at the camera photographing him, but perhaps at the spot where his camera is pointing. Settled. Sandy Hook Suit, A Historic Victory, by Melissa Chan. Remington Arms has settled a wrongful death lawsuit with nine families who lost loved ones in the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting for $73 million, attorneys announced February 15. The settlement ends a long-running legal battle over how Remington marketed the rifle used in the 2012 massacre. Though it means the suit ended without a verdict, it is the first time a U.S. gun manufacturer has been held liable in a mass shooting, the plaintiff's lawyers said, and could open the door to future lawsuits against gun makers. Josh Koskoff, an attorney representing the family, says it should be a wake-up call to the firearms industry, which is largely immune to lawsuits under federal law. Our hope is that this victory will be the first boulder in the avalanche that forces that change, he says. These nine families have shared a single goal from the very beginning, to do whatever they could to help prevent the next Sandy Hook. While the families remembered those they lost, they expressed relief at the outcome. Today is about what is right and what is wrong, says Francine Wheeler, whose six-year-old son Ben was killed in the shooting. Also died, Bette Davis, that's B-E-T-T-Y, celebrated funk singer-songwriter at 77, February 9. Lata Mangeshkar, playback singer known as India's Queen of Melody at 92, February 6. P.J. O'Rourke, conservative author, satirist, and political commentator on February 15 at 74. Recorded, the Cook Islands' first ever COVID-19 case, February 13. Dismissed, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin's defamation case against the New York Times by a district judge, February 15. A jury later also ruled in the Times' favor. Resigned, Cressida Dick, London's police commissioner, February 10. After a recent report found widespread misogyny and racism within the city's police force, a arrested former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, February 15, on drug trafficking charges. Renamed Facebook's news feed, February 15, as simply feed. More the brief highs and lows, four short articles under the banner of the Olympic set of five rings. Snowboarding. Chloe Kim secured her status as the world's top women's half-pipe snowboarder, earning gold with her first run at the Games. Kim's win makes her the first woman to win back-to-back Olympic gold medals in the event. Alpine skiing. It was impressive enough that Sofia Goggia could compete in Beijing, let alone take home silver in the women's downhill. The Italian alpine skier tore her ACL and fractured her fibula 3 weeks before the Games. Curling, C-U-R-L-I-N-G. Two hospital nurses, Team USA's Nina Roth and Britain's Vicky Wright, took a break from the front lines of the pandemic to represent their countries as vice skips on the women's curling teams. Biathlon. Norway's Marta Olsbu Røiseland is racking up a record haul with three golds in two solo events plus a relay and a bronze. She is the first woman to win four biathlon medals in one Olympics. Climate, Artificial Snow's Slippery Slope by Chad de Guzman. There's a photo here. It's quite glorious looking. Artificial snow covers Beijing's National Alpine Skiing Center February 6. There are brown mountains in the background. Some have a white snow caps, or perhaps they're fake ski runs on them. And then right down the center towards the front of the photo, the foreground, is this wide swath of white contained by red fences, and on either side there are what look like new, probably prefabricated, light gray metal buildings. I don't see anybody in the photo, although there are some dots in the far ground that might be people. Nearly 100% of the snow at the 2020 Beijing Winter Olympics was artificial, pumped out by snow machines rather than by Mother Nature. The lack of natural snow is a first for Winter Games, though the machine-made stuff has become increasingly common. Artificial snow was first used at the 1980 Winter Olympics in Lake Placid, New York, to supplement natural snowfall. It has grown substantially in importance since. About 80% of the snow used in Sochi in 2014 was artificial, and up to 98% of the snow for the 2018 Pyeongchang Games was machine-made. The reliance on artificial snow in Beijing highlights an escalating problem with hosting a snow-based global event as the climate changes. There's essentially no natural snowfall in the Chinese capital, and the average daytime temperature does not drop below freezing in February. Beijing has also faced decades-long chronic water scarcity. Available fresh water is just 7% of the UN standard for water sufficiency. Beijing organizers said the estimated 49 million gallons of water needed to cover ski slopes, some of which are outside the city, would not strain water supplies. Chinese leaders have touted the 2022 Games as the greenest ever, using wind and solar energy to power the snow machines. But to rely 100% on artificial snow does signal the Olympics have landed in a place that is not climatically suitable, says Madeline Orr, a sports ecologist at Loughborough University in the UK. Even artificial snow can only substitute for the real stuff if temperatures are low enough to keep it from melting. If we have certain mountain regions that are just too warm, no amount of snowmaking is going to fix that, Orr says. Indeed, a January study from the University of Waterloo in Canada found only one of the 21 previous hosts of the Winter Games, Sapporo, Japan, would still have the requisite precipitation and temperatures to stage the games by 2080. More the brief Olympics, highs and lows. Snowboarding. After five Olympics, Shaun White ended his stellar career on a bittersweet note. The American entered as an underdog and missed the podium after wiping out on his last run. "This is it for me," he said, getting emotional after the event. Nordic combined. Despite the Beijing Olympics being the most gender-neutral winter games to date, Nordic combined remains an equity outlier. The event, combining ski jumping and cross-country, remains the only winter sport in which women cannot compete. Ski jumping. Five women ski jumpers were DQ'd from the mixed team final over jumpsuits that officials deemed too baggy, despite clearing them in earlier jumps. Norway's ski jumping chief of sports called it one of the sport's darker days. Too baggy. Snowboarding. Snowboarders are criticizing the sport's scoring system after judges in men's half pipe and slope style gave high scores to runs with mistakes, as when gold medalist Max Parrott of Canada grabbed his knee, not his board. Next, there's a photo of a young man in motion. Black tights, black skates, a red shirt, a mop of black hair, fingers pointing in the air with the half-finger gloves, and he's skating on a white surface with pale blue, red, and yellow stripes in it. Nathan Chen finally gets his gold medal. This is figure skating by Alice Park. It took one more Olympics than he and everyone else in the figure skating world expected, but American Nathan Chen, C-H-E-N, finally has his Olympic medal, and it is gold. The 22-year-old Salt Lake City native skated the program of his life in Beijing's Capital Indoor Stadium February 10 to stand atop the podium. Japan filled the remaining spots, with Yuma Kageyama earning silver and Shoma Uno bronze. "I just had a blast out there," says Chen, who skated to a medley of Elton John tunes, including Rocket Man. "I am so happy. That program is so much fun to skate." It was Chen's goal to lose, just as it was heading into the games 4 years ago. He was considered a favorite in Pyeongchang, but Chen could not meet the moment and skated an uncharacteristically error-filled short program that led to his finishing off the podium entirely. The performance fueled the Yale students over the past 4 years. Indeed, talk to any member of Chen's team and they say the same thing. He knows what he wants. And in Beijing, Chen wanted to prove his performance in Pyeongchang did not define him. Chen set a world record with his score in the short program February 8, easily taking the lead with a margin of almost 6 points. He built on the momentum in the free program, effortlessly landing 5 quadruple jumps and cementing his reputation as one of the most talented men's figure skaters in history. The Rocket Man program was a departure for Chen, who normally skates to more abstract music selections. For the choreography, he approached noted ice dance coach Marie-France Dubreuil, who coaches the top three U.S. ice dance teams. "I was looking to change up the choreography and had seen the amazing work Marie-France was doing," Chen told Time before the games. Dubreuil was puzzled when Chen reached out. "Normally, my head likes to create for 4 legs, 4 arms, 2 heads, and 4 eyes, she says. "When he called me, I said, why?" Dubreuil helped introduce Chen to hip-hop choreographer Sam Chouinard. The fast and boisterous dance sequence at the end, a hit with both fans and judges, was Chouinard's effort to show a different side of Chen. "I tried to see if he can dance and perform when he's getting ready to jump, so it would be easier to tell the story and easier to keep the audience involved in what he was trying to do on the ice," Chouinard said. When skaters understand the blend of the two, this is the perfect recipe for gold. For Chan, the gold medal is the payoff for a lifetime of training that began on the practice rink for the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympics, and for the long hours his mother spent driving him a couple of times a month from their Utah home to Los Angeles, where he started taking lessons when he was 12. My mom's been with me since the first day I stepped on the ice, and even now is right by my side, he told Time. When I was 12, we did not have the finances to afford flights, so driving was the only way to get me back and forth at the time. It finally paid off with gold. The View, Nation, Rethinking Risk by Scott Gottlieb. As the pandemic has evolved and most Americans have sought vaccines for protection, and as those who chose to forego vaccination became infected often more than once, the risk that COVID-19 poses for most Americans has declined. It is estimated more than 90% of Americans have some level of immunity to COVID-19 through vaccination or prior infection. Along with this wall of immunity, approaches adopted when we had few tools to prevent spread are no longer providing benefits that always justify their costs of social disruption, diminished classroom experiences, and economic drag. But we have been slow to adapt our strategies to the evolving notions of risk. The CDC is soon expected to update its policies, moving away from national recommendations and instead tying to measures of local prevalence its guidance for the protective steps people should take. This community-by-community standard may not be enough. We've turned restrictions on, but have not turned them off as conditions changed. In many cases, it is because we're still relying on the same metrics we used at the start of the pandemic. These concepts for measuring risk have remained mostly fixed since that time, even as people acquired protection from the virus. At the outset of the pandemic, we had a shared sense of threat and a shared willingness to sacrifice a lot to deal with it. As the pandemic has evolved and its burdens accumulated, that social compact has frayed. Now we need to shift from measures adopted collectively to tactics taken individually by people who are judging their own individual risk against their degree of caution. This means we must accept more regional and local variation in measures adopted at the state level. The government's role will be to make sure people have the tools they need to make those choices. Steps that were critical in 2020 to reduce death and health care strain when we were overwhelmed are no longer justifiable. But what anchors that change? Even when actions were adjusted based on risk, in many cases it came too slow. Without deliberate guideposts, it is hard to gauge why one posture should give way to another and how to make these decisions. Now in 2022, we need to leave those 2020 notions of risk behind. What was judged to be moderate prevalence this time last year, when we were largely unvaccinated, may be the new low when our vulnerability has declined, especially as we confront a more transmissible but less severe strain like Omicron. Since then, more Americans have acquired immunity through vaccination and successive waves of infection. By some estimates, almost 70% of Americans have been infected at least once. About 87% of adults have had at least one dose of vaccine. We have a growing reserve of therapies that can treat the sick and substantially reduce the risk of hospitalization or death. The U.S. will soon be producing almost a half billion at-home COVID tests each month. We've also seen dramatic advances in our care of the sick. Confidence in public health has eroded because we've been too slow to adapt the steps we take to changing notions of risk. Some people are adopting their own measures to reduce their risk and voluntarily choosing to avoid congregate settings, wear masks, and take other precautions. Many people are excessively vulnerable to COVID-19 because of age or health conditions, and those who remain worried should have access to tools and support to keep safe. There's understandable apprehension among parents, torn between fears of the virus and the steps to keep kids safe, especially toddlers. But for those who feel more confident about the declining risks, we can only ask so much of the public for so long. There is an amassed effect from the disruptions. People are exhausted. Livelihoods and people's mental health have been hurt by the diminished lives we've had to compromise around. Many children have not known a normal school day for 2 years. The constant disruptions take a cumulative toll. We never agreed that the costs can outweigh the benefits. The problem is we have no way of measuring these trade-offs, no framework for deciding when to turn things off, and equally important, turn them on. COVID-19 will remain a fearsome virus for the foreseeable future, but one that we must learn how to live with. Federal health officials have steered us through one of the hardest periods in our country's modern history and helped preserve life, even as we lost more than 900,000 of our fellow citizens. We have gradually found a way to coexist with this virus. Now we need a glide path to what normal becomes and a new math to guide how we adapt to COVID-19, even if we never fully defeat it. Dr. Gottlieb, the author, was commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration from 2017 to 2019. He is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a board member at Pfizer, Inc. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. This is a different type of risk. A new Iran nuclear deal likely to remain stalled. In Vienna, an eighth round of talks on Iran's nuclear program continues, with little cause for hope that a deal is near. The Biden administration wants a return to the so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The nuclear deal agreed to in 2015 by Iran, the Obama administration, France, the UK, Germany, Russia, and China. Then President Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. from that deal in 2018, and Biden ran for president on pledges to bring it back. For now, Iran's negotiators remain at the table, but they've made clear Iran is far from satisfied with the terms on offer. A decision in early February by Iran's army to show off a new long-range missile does not help. The talks are not dead. In fact, a return to JCPOA would, in some ways, be easier than it was to reach the original agreement. The Biden administration appears willing to accept a deal with looser limits on nuclear activity and to lift sanctions that were not part of the original agreement. In addition, parts of JCPOA begin to expire in a few years. Iran would not be making long-term concessions. By signing again on the dotted line, Iran could regain access to $100 billion in frozen foreign reserves and sell more oil at a market price that's near $100 per barrel. A return to JCPOA would also open new trade and investment opportunities for an Iranian economy that badly needs them. But Iran's government, now led by hardline President Ebrahim Raisi, may not feel Iran needs the boost. China's willingness to ignore U.S. sanctions in order to buy Iranian oil has provided Tehran an economic lifeline it did not have when JCPOA was signed in 2015. That is part of why Iran's currency has strengthened against the dollar over the past 2 months to the highest level since Raisi became president. Iran has reason not to trust Biden administration promises. U.S. elections are on the horizon, and the GOP, which is generally more hostile than Democrats to any bargaining with Iran, is likely to take majority control of both houses of Congress. Today, Republicans cannot block a Biden deal, but they can't complicate its implementation. They can also propose new sanctions on Iran, which, even with a Biden veto, could discourage or delay the return of international investment to Iran. Then, of course, there's the 2024 presidential election. The return of Trump, or the election of a Trump-endorsed nominee, would likely again scuttle any agreement. Another reason there may be no deal. The Biden team is mightily distracted at the moment. With its pandemic policy in flux, inflation at historically high levels, its legislative agenda stalled, a credible risk that Russia will invade Ukraine, and a need to focus more attention on China, a new Iran deal cannot be a top priority. The U.S. won't remain at the bargaining table forever. Iran's now accelerating the development of its nuclear program. Washington knows it cannot allow Iran to use endless talks as cover to build a bomb. But if bargaining breaks down completely later this spring, Iran could move quickly toward amassing enough highly enriched uranium for several bombs, advancing closer to an actual nuclear weapon than it has ever been. If that happens, Washington will hit Iran with new sanctions, and Israel might well launch sabotage attacks on Iran's physical and digital infrastructure. The risk of an escalating military conflict cannot be ignored. Under the heading History, Reconstructions, Black Politicians, this is by Olivia B. Waxman. At least 34 laws restricting access to voting were passed by 19 states in 2021, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. Some historians argue this wave of laws making it harder to vote echoes the backlash to the electoral gains made by African Americans during Reconstruction, 1865 to 1877, the era of political revolution in the aftermath of the Civil War. Reconstruction was the first time this country tried to be an interracial democracy, or a democracy, in other words, says Eric Foner, F-O-N-E-R, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of Reconstruction. Foner, the author of Freedom's Lawmakers, estimates about 2,000 black Americans held public office at the local, state, and federal levels during Reconstruction. One of black office holders' biggest contributions was their role in establishing state-sponsored public schools. Among the notable black office holders in this era, Republican Hiram Revels of Mississippi, the first black U.S. senator, and Robert Smalls, who escaped enslavement and went on to serve five terms in the U.S. House of Representatives. But black office holder numbers started to decline after 1877. Although the 15th Amendment to the Constitution said states could not restrict voting based on race, state legislators passed laws that mandated expensive poll taxes, fees to vote, and literacy tests, questions with no right answers, and subjected African Americans to them more than white Americans. It was not until nearly a century later that the 1965 Voting Rights Act made literacy tests and poll taxes illegal. More from Olympic highs and lows. Freestyle skiing, with a trick in which he stopped his rotation midair and changed direction. Freestyle skier Alex Hall led the U.S. to a 1-2 finish. The country has won 6 of 9 medals in the men's event since its debut. Older athletes, aging athletes, are having a moment. Per an NPR tally, there are 140 Olympians in Beijing over the age of 35. That's an older athlete, apparently. Many, like France's silver medalist Johan Clary, 41, are standing on the podium, too. Bobsled, Team USA, made history in the inaugural Olympic monobob event, with Kaylee Humphreys and Alana Myers-Taylor, the first women to win gold and silver, respectively. Christine De Bruin of Canada took bronze. Speed skating. Erin, that's E-R-I-N, Jackson, became the first black woman to win a solo Olympic speed skating medal and the first U.S. woman to win speed skating gold since 1994. Cried so much I put on my medal backward, she tweeted. And here's a photo on the same page of the Olympic highs and lows column. It's Team China freestyle skater Eileen Gu, G-U. She flies the flag of China after medaling February 15. Competing for China February 8, the U.S.-born freestyle skater Eileen Gu landed a spectacular left double 16-20 with safety grab on her final run to win gold. She had never pulled off the daring trick in competition before, much less in front of a global audience, and it instantly made her one of the game's biggest stars. Gu is being caught in the wider political crossfire between the U.S. and China in ways that other athletes are not, says Jules Boykoff, a sports and politics expert at Pacific University. Her decision to compete for China has thrust her into a political firestorm. And those few paragraphs were excerpted by a politics article, Eileen Gu Skis into a Global Standoff, by Amy Gunilla. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.